Good afternoon, everyone, or I maybe should say good evening because I've noticed it's gotten dark outside. Thanks for sticking with it to the last session of the day. As Becca mentioned earlier, I'm Helen Dombalis. I'm the Policy and Strategic Partnerships Director for the National Farm to School Network. I'm based in Washington, D.C., where federal policy happens or sometimes doesn't happen. The Farm to School Network, or the National Farm to School Network, really works at the intersection, like we've heard about even most recently in Holly's presentation, at the intersection of agriculture, public health, local food systems, our environment, our economy, and equity. So specifically, the way I always talk about Farm to School is a triple win. It's a win for kids, it's a win for farmers, and it's a win for communities. So as an example of that, we know that when kids participate in farm-to-school programs, that they actually increase their consumptions of fruits and their consumption of fruits and vegetables. If they grow that carrot at the school garden, or if they've met the school gardener, if they've met the farmer who's grown that carrot, they're going to be more willing to eat it, and then they'll realize they like the carrot, and then they'll keep eating them. So for farmers, we know that farm-to-school is a win, because when you're buying from a farmer in your community, you're shortening that supply chain, and the farmer is able to keep a bigger share of the dollar. And then that last piece, the win for communities, we know happens because kids take what they learn at school through their farm-to-school programs back home to their families. Families get involved. You're keeping more of the dollar in the local community. So that's just a little bit of background on farm-to-school, and I'll talk about some federal farm-to-school policy, but also just some broader sustainable agriculture policy. As Becca mentioned, I previously worked for the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition, and the National Farm to School Network, where I'm now based, is a member of the Sustainable Agriculture Coalition. So I'm definitely connected to that larger piece of sustainable agriculture policy. I do want to mention, I don't have a slide, but I have nothing to disclose. So just this first slide, I want to talk a little bit about and the overview of our agricultural production in this country and its impacts on soil, air, water, just in general on our environment. So as you can see up at the top, we know that over half of the land in production in the lower 48 states is farms and ranches. And I just put that up there so, you know, we really get a sense of the scale that we're talking about. When we're looking at the way that we produce food, we realize that that current system has massive implications all across the country on our environment. So some specific things that we do have listed up here: use of fertilizers that are fossil fuels, use of pesticides or chemicals in our food system, production of greenhouse gases, heavy metals. There was mentioned earlier about concentrated animal feeding operations where you've got, you know, thousands and thousands of animals in a specific location, and the fecal coliform and other waste that comes as a byproduct of that production system. So, you know, we know that over the decades, the last few decades in this country, we really have consolidated farms. The average age of a farmer now is 57 in this country and growing. We have a young farmer here in the room today, which is wonderful. And we're starting to see more of the next generation get engaged in farming, but we know that when we consolidated farms over the past several decades, that the farms themselves have had to get bigger, and then farmers, as a result, to manage more and more acres, have had to get more inventive and really look towards more mechanization and more industrialization, which has had massive impacts on the environment and then therefore on environmental health. That last piece on there you can see is that agriculture is the largest user of water in the U.S., so it's a water quantity issue. Of course, in the Southwest, we know that already there are issues with water quantity, so we have to figure out ways to address that. And then also it's the largest source of pollution in our rivers and streams, so it's also a water quality issue. So now that we've talked a little bit about the agricultural production in this country, I want to talk about three specific federal policies and then, of course, tie it back to state and local policy as the other presenters have done. So over on the right-hand side, that's just the diagram that really represents the policy process. So someone comes up with an idea or a concept, and I'm sorry, I'm not sure. the words are a little bit off. Sorry about that. But you come up with your policy idea. So what is it that you want to advance, or what is it that you want to achieve through policy? you get to your authorization process. So that's writing the legislation or the laws, working with, of course, at the federal level, Congress. Appropriations is funding whatever it is you've written into law. Implementation, that's where the relevant agency, so USDA, the Department of Agriculture, has already been mentioned as an example of that. So the relevant federal agency actually implements that law. And then you evaluate it. You see what worked, what you want to change before you get back to kind of coming up with new concepts before you get a chance to work on the law again. So today I'm going to talk about three different pieces of federal legislation at three different places in that policy process. The Farm Bill, for folks who might have been following this, know it's been a very long reauthorization process. Many advocates have been working on it for over 3 or more years trying to get a new Farm Bill. So that's that authorization process. The Food Safety Modernization Act is in the implementation process, so I'll talk in a few minutes about how the FDA is currently taking what Congress passed into law and putting the regulations together for that. And then the third is the Child Nutrition Reauthorization, which right now is kind of in that evaluation stage. So earlier, Aliza mentioned the 2010 Child Nutrition Reauthorization. Now, advocates and members of Congress are starting to look towards 2015 when that bill expires. What's been working? What do we need to change? So I'm going to go through those three pieces. And I think the reason I really want to explain this policy process is for you all to realize that laws don't just get passed. Then they have to get implemented, and then we have to evaluate them to figure out what we want to do next time we get to write laws. And the point there is that all of you can be engaged at every single one of these places along the way. So first, the Farm Bill. This was mentioned by the other presenters as well because it does have implications for state and local policy. As I mentioned, we don't have a new Farm Bill yet, so I'm working with the information from the last Farm Bill, which was passed in 2008. So the Farm Bill has titles, or it's another just a fancy way of saying chapters. And as you can see on the slide, the Farm Bill includes everything from commodity production and crop insurance, so products like corn, soybeans, wheat, cotton. It has conservation programs in it. I'll talk about those more in a minute as they impact environmental health very significantly. It has things like the nutrition program. Someone earlier mentioned SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or food stamps. That's actually the biggest chunk of spending in the Farm Bill. But there are other programs in the nutrition title, like programs for farm to school or for farmers markets. Research programs, I'm going to give a couple of examples in a minute. So as you look through the list, what you realize is the Farm Bill has incredible implications for our agriculture and food systems because it impacts who grows what's grown, how it's grown, and then who actually has access to what once it's produced. So the Farm Bill is really key in terms of every person along the food chain from the farmer to the end consumer. So specifically within the Farm Bill, I'm going to talk about some conservation programs and then some research programs that have impacts on environmental health. So within conservation programs, there's a specific suite of programs called the Working Lands Programs. So these are the programs that, as the name implies, actually are used by farmers who are currently producing. So they're working the lands at this time. So for land still in production, these types of conservation programs actually encourage more environmentally protective practices. So I talked earlier about some of what we've seen over the decades towards industrial agriculture. So what the idea here is to actually encourage, as farmers are producing food and other fiber and fuel for the country, to really look at doing it in more environmentally friendly ways. So Holly actually already referenced the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, or EQIP. So one example that I'll give of that as it relates to environmental health is the use of EQIP for a cost share for manure lagoons at concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, which I mentioned earlier. So the idea there is to give farmers some funding to actually have a manure lagoon so that the manure is more contained as opposed to it directly going out into the water, producing greenhouse gases into the air. So using that again to really advance environmental protection. And then the other example I'll mention is the Conservation Stewardship Program, or CSP. So that program includes grant funding and also technical assistance. One specific example, there would be allowing farmers to use CSP funding to install drip irrigation, which improves water efficiency. So, you know, I talked earlier about water quality being a major issue. This program, CSP, can allow farmers to be more water conscious as they're producing. And then research programs, the Organic Agriculture Research and Extension Initiative, OREI, and then the Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education Program, SARE. These two programs work for sustainable farmers and also specifically for organic farmers to figure out what they need. So testing different varieties of a bell pepper, for example, playing with different inputs like nitrogen, really figuring out what's best in terms of soil to grow in manners that are better for the environment sustainably and organically. And I apologize, this is apparently a problem with my slides that is not going to end. I'm not sure what the issue is. Yeah, I use a Mac and I'm going to blame it on the PC. Thank you, Becca. I think that must be the issue. But these slides are, I should say, since they're cutting off, they will be available online. So that's the Farm Bill. Now I'm going to talk about the Food Safety Modernization Act, or FSMA. We love acronyms in Washington. So FSMA is the first major overhaul of our nation's food safety practices since 1938. I mention that because I want folks to understand that this doesn't happen often. We don't get this chance often to actually weigh in terms of how we're regulating food production and food safety laws in this country. So as a result, since we don't get to do it very often, we want to make sure that it's done right this time. So I mentioned earlier when I was explaining that policy process that for FSMA, it's the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, that's actually the agency now implementing those laws that Congress passed. And then specifically, the regulations include growing, harvesting, packing, and holding of fresh produce, so that's the produce rule, and then facilities that are processing food for people to eat, and that's the preventive controls rule. So those are the two specifically that have really strong implications for food production in this country around produce, and then aggregation, processing, et cetera, of that food for all of us to eat. I want to just make a note, too, that FSMA does not have impacts on the regulations for meat, poultry, and eggs. That's actually handled by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the USDA. So there are a lot of things in the Food Safety Modernization Act that folks are looking at right now in terms of how they're going to impact environmental health. FDA is actually those two pieces that I mentioned, the produce rule and the preventive controls rule. FDA is accepting comments on those through November 15th. My organization will be submitting comments, and APHA will be submitting comments, and if you feel super inspired during the next few minutes of my presentation to submit your own comments, you still have time. We have a little less than 2 weeks to do that, and it's really important to do so. So, as I've talked about, there are a lot of farming practices that can improve and advance environmental health. Some of those conservation programs, research programs, ways to really address the trend that we've seen in agriculture production in the last several decades. So as FDA is now implementing the Food Safety Modernization Act, what we want to do is make sure that these practices, these sustainable agriculture practices, can continue and really expand for agricultural producers. But what we have to also do, and this is that both and piece of my slide, we have to make sure that FDA is also is addressing the fact that there are foodborne illnesses in this country and that people do get sick from food. So we want to make sure that the way that FDA ultimately puts out their final rule, their final kind of implementation of what Congress passed into law, they take both of those into perspective. They recognize that we need to protect consumer health and make sure that consumers are not getting sick, but they also need to recognize and realize that we have a lot of advancements through sustainable agriculture that are also protecting health. So we need to make sure that in the end, both of those can work together. So specifically, the few points on this slide, I'm going to talk about kind of get at that both and approach. So the first one, ensuring food security and dietary diversity. So we know that diversified farms build soil health, build the quality of the soil. And diversified farms are farms that they don't have a monocrop. They're not just corn, they're not just soybeans, they're not just carrots, but they have a lot of different types of products. And when you have all of those different products working together, you can build the health of the soil because each product can bring different nutrients to the soil. And then we also know that when you have diversified farm operations, that's going to improve the health, the dietary diversity, and the health of the consumer. Because as we all know, we need to eat more than just one type of fruit or one type of vegetable. We want to be consuming lots of those. So what we want to make sure with the Food Safety Modernization Act is that those types of diversified operations can continue to be successful, that they don't have to deal with a different regulation for every single product, but rather that they can have one plan if they've got 80 fruits and vegetables that can work for all of those. Another is supporting local and regional food systems. So we know that there are massive gains in local and regional food systems. There's a farm-to-school program in every country now. More consumers are asking. Oh, thank you, state. That would be amazing. Thank you. Yeah. I'm thinking big. Yeah, one day. Every state. Thank you. I got ahead of myself. We know that that consumers are starting to ask where their food is coming from and how it's grown. So we know that we have all of these gains, and we want to make sure it's that both and, that all of those gains that are happening, food hubs, so facilities that are aggregating product and then sending it to the school, we want to make sure that those small entrepreneurial businesses can continue to be successful. Next, developing water standards that don't increase chemical use. So that really gets to the both and. We want to make sure that as FDA implements their rules, they're not telling farmers, just go out and sterilize everything. We want to make sure that they're making the water standards such that we're not going to be polluting water as we're also trying to protect the consumer through the production. And then not wanting to conflict with the National Organic Program and other conservation practices that I've described, because as we know, sustainable agriculture and organic agriculture can really help advance environmental outcomes. So there are some specific pieces of the Food Safety Modernization Act that we're weighing in with FDA on to really say, hey, make sure that we allow what's currently working and what's currently advancing environmental health to continue. And then finally, I'll just mention the child nutrition reauthorization. So this is one that is currently being implemented, but it's also being evaluated in terms of looking at the next steps. So the next bill expires on September 30th of 2015. So advocates and Congress alike are starting to kind of gear up and figure out what they're going to want to do for the next child nutrition bill. And that bill includes a lot of programs, just like the Farm Bill, child nutrition and school meal programs. So this is the list of those. It's the school lunch and school breakfast programs, snack programs, after school and summer feeding programs. And then I'll mention also the fresh fruit and vegetable program, which really ensures kids are eating fresh produce. And then down at the bottom, the farm to school grant program, which my organization advocated to get funding for during the 2010 bill. So within farm to school, I just want to mention this because it definitely ties to environmental health. There are, under the farm-to-school umbrella, kind of four key components. So one is local procurement, and that's kind of self-evident, farm-to-school, so getting farm-fresh product to a school. Secondly, there's school gardens. I mentioned that earlier. Third, experiential education, so that's getting kids out to a farm to meet a farmer or bringing a farmer to a classroom, getting kids to really experience the food system. And then the fourth piece of farm-to-school is food and agriculture curriculum. So that's, in a history class, kids growing a garden that looks at what has agricultural production looked like in this country over the last several hundred years. What was it like during native populations lived in this country? And then what does it look like today? Or in a math class, it's getting kids to weigh their food scraps and then take averages. So as they're learning their core competencies like math and history, they're also learning about the food system. So that relates because as kids are learning about food and agriculture curriculum, they're also learning about the environment and environmental health. I actually was in Tucson a few weeks ago and had a kid tell me, did you know that when these worms eat this compost, that makes that soil healthy for all of us when we grow our food? It's pretty amazing. So it definitely connects. So we're going to be looking at the next child nutrition bill and really trying to figure out ways to advance environmental education within the farm to school grant program. And then lastly, on my last messed up slide, I just want to make sure that we all know, of course, as has already been mentioned, that these things don't happen in isolation. The local and state policy presentations, of course, reference the implications that federal policy has at the state and local level. But the same is also true. Local policies, like local food policy councils, help inform what happens at the federal level. So what's been done, for example, around food safety in Colorado is helping inform the implementation now of the Food Safety Modernization Act. Or a lot of state legislation has happened around farm to school. So using that model legislation for then what we advocate for at the federal level. And with that, I will stop. This is my contact information. I also just want to point out that the National Farm to School Network every other year convenes the Farm to Cafeteria Conference. So it's farm to school, farm to prison, farm to hospital, farm to college. So the next one will be April 15th through 18th in Austin, Texas. And I've got save the date cards if you're interested. I can give them to you afterwards. So thanks.
Thank you, Helen. So we'll start to see if there are any specific questions for our presenters, and then we would love to also hear about the work that any of you are doing. Yes. One second. Did everybody hear the question? You want me to repeat it? In the back? Did you hear it? Okay. Go ahead.
Yes, but there is wonderful research that actually shows when kids are growing their own food, meeting their farmer, that they do consume more servings of fruits and vegetables. We actually have a fact sheet called The Benefits of Farm to School. I encourage you to go on our website and look under resources. You can see that fact sheet. And it's really nicely broken down. It's like public health benefits, farmer economic benefit, community benefit. So kind of, it's essentially a lit review of all the research that's been done as of about a year ago on farm to school.
Other questions? Yes.
Can you tell me about the role of health professionals and education?
Yeah, I think we could all comment on that. I'll start with the Food and Environment Working Group, which is part of APHA. So if you are an APHA member, you can join the working group. And we currently, a few people within the working group wrote some draft comments for the Food Safety Modernization Act that Helen was just mentioning. And right now we're circulating that draft out to the entire working group for other people to give us some feedback if they have any specific feedback. There are opportunities if there's a specific bill up either in your county, state, or at the federal level where having somebody come in who is a health professional to speak to the health benefits or the health risks of an environment, of an agricultural practice, that can really sway a policymaker in a way that may not just hearing from the same agriculture lobbyist or farmer that they've heard from before a bunch of times in their district, but to have a health person come in and say, hey, look, there are these other implications. So your voice is really important. But do you want to add anything?
Legislators and their staff are like, farm that we work with, but also tries to organize health professionals to advocate within their institution. So, you know, if there's something, or there's a lot around hospital policy, around food, and environmental pieces as well, that the staff, all the staff in the hospital can have a really big impact.
I just want to see if anybody else in the audience wants to respond to that, because I know there are health professionals who do this kind of work. So before we go to another question, does anybody want to respond to that question?
I'll respond as a former Senate staffer, U.S. Senate staffer, and we certainly form relationships with people in the state health professionals that are partners with people, basically because we couldn't say things that you could say, but we could use your quote. And especially if you're in an academic setting,
thank you. Other questions? Yes.
This is a question for Molly, and I'm curious in the state convenings, to what extent were, what kinds of environmental issues were people looking at and trying to address through a systemic approach, and to what degree are people talking about climate change and resilient farming, climate resilient farming practices?
Did folks hear that question? So the question is about in the state meetings, to what extent was the, what kinds of conversations were happening around environmental health issues, and to what extent was climate change addressed, and to talking about producing food in ways that would be resilient in the face of climate change and that sort of thing. So.
I will say though, we did not fund the California Climate Action,
Climate Action Network.
Thank you. Really works a lot on those issues, and they actually applied. They were one of the 60 some applying organizations that were not funded, but they did put on a really incredible summit this past February, I think it was, that I was able to attend, and they looked. They were talking a lot about strategies with sort of carbon sequestration through soil health and composting and biochar and things like that as ways of combating climate change through good agricultural practices. So we didn't really see them coming up a lot in our meetings, but they're definitely those conversations happening. And I think that I'm happy that you raised that, because I think that we should be raising those issues more and looking at how agriculture can be a partner in combating those issues rather than contributing.
And those state meetings were really designed to have these sort of initial incipient conversations between agriculture groups and health groups, and sometimes I think getting at those really hard issues of how agriculture is contributing to climate change but also how it could help it is maybe a few steps down the line once more of the trust is built between the health groups and the agriculture groups. And so we're hoping down the line that the coalition will be able to raise more money in order to have more of these meetings and facilitate more of those conversations and get to topics like that. So thanks, Holly. Other questions? And yes.
So I was really interested for Holly Helen, you were discussing about the food safety modernization. And it wasn't something I had really thought about before, that that might affect local, potentially, you know, sustainable growing farmers. I was wondering if you could talk more about what those concerns are that the food safety modernization might bring about.
Sure. Yeah. All farmers will be impacted by the Food Safety Modernization Act, as will others that, as I mentioned earlier, handle food, so facilities, for example. Specifically, farms are going to have to register. There are some modified exemptions for the very smallest of farmers, but it's not modified if you're sustainable or organic. It's based on size, your gross annual sales. So farms farms are going to have to register, and then they're going to have to pay money for doing so and have to fill out a lot of paperwork, which is why there are these modified exemptions for the very smallest of farmers, so that those burdensome paperwork and cost pieces don't actually make them have to go out of business.
And you had mentioned about diversified farming, eventually having more hurdles to overcome.
Correct. Yeah, so there's a specific piece of the produce rule. FDA right now is leaning towards making it, unless you grow sprouts, which is it's just in its own category because there's such high risk from sprouts. Unless you grow sprouts, FDA is looking right now at saying if you have 80 vegetables, you have just one set of guidelines. But they were really asking for input on that because they have also considered saying, let's have a specific set of guidelines for tomatoes, cantaloupes, corn. So then if you have 80 fruits and vegetables, you have 80 different sets of guidelines. So that's one thing that, for example, the Farmers Whole Network is weighing in on and saying, make it easy, sprout fine, they're their own category, but if you have 80 fruits and vegetables, let's just have one set of guidelines. And the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition actually has an amazing website. They've broken it down. You can go on their website and say, I'm a farmer, I'm a consumer, I deal with food hubs, and kind of figure out, based on who you are and how you're engaged in the food system, what the impacts are, and then what you could tell FDA.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you all so much for a wonderful presentation. I personally enjoyed it. It's great. I wanted to ask, at some point you mentioned countries, and maybe you didn't have time to say a lot about it. Are there countries that are taking much of your strategies as models for what they need to take back?
So that was a flip. when I said all countries in the world have farm to school. But there are countries that are implementing, for example, farm to school programs. Our executive director and co-founder is from India. So India is actually an amazing model for farm to school programs now. I know that there are a number, I spent some time in Kenya, and I know that Kenya also has a lot of farm to school programs. We have a section on our website where you can learn more about international work.
And I'll just comment, not in terms of these programs, but there is a free trade agreement between Europe and the U.S. that's being talked about and negotiated right now. And Europe has some stricter standards around how food is produced and what kinds of food is made available to folks, both in terms of genetically modified food, as well as some of the production practices. And so we don't know yet whose rules are going to win out in that agreement. Is it the U.S. rules and then Europe will be producing in ways that aren't as environmentally sustainable? Or are Europe's rules going to influence us? And so that's another way to think about some of the international perspective of this. Yes.
Neighborhood I live in is like not, is a little atypical.
and Lauren can chime in too.
Yeah, so I went to quite a few of the neighborhoods that helped the zoning laws, and people were, there was a lot of discussion around whether or not farms should have farm stands in residential neighborhoods, but then you're having a commercial use in a residential neighborhood, and as a zoning authority, they think, oh, well, you don't want that, that's pretty close, but when you're looking at food access, and when you're looking at that being one of the key elements of urban agriculture, then you have to really think about whether or not you want to have that as a right, whether you want to have that as a competition for it, that kind of thing. People were worried about, people were actually most worried about chickens and meat, which was interesting because that ended up having to be a neighborhood by neighborhood process, because it was included in a few of the neighborhood zoning regulations. People who were really pro chickens were really upset that it was neighborhood by neighborhood. People who were really anti-chickens were really worried about the noise and the smell and the critters and that kind of thing. And a lot of people were worried about GMOs, about use of pesticides, about kind of industrial farming techniques being done next door to them. And that's something that I think can be addressed by kind of educating about why people might use what they use on these, you know, multi-dominator farms and why that might not work on a quarter-acre farm.
Thanks. Other questions? And if, yes?
Well, my question is a couple parts, but they relate to each other. So one of the presentations we're hearing about, among other things, how food policy councils are often understaffed, volunteer-run, and that, you know, that brings certain challenges. And then also when we were talking about SNAP, I was thinking about how lately the dialogue on SNAP has been, how do we keep it at certain levels, how do we keep certain cuts from expiring? And those two things to me seem related examples of a systemic problem, which is, while the presentations today focused really on the positive things, the ways that we're moving forward, the way we're improving messaging, we're finding what works, it seems like there's too many situations where we're still running just to stay in the same place, and we're not necessarily owning the conversation, and then that leads to limits in funding and time. Do you have some examples of things that we can do to undo that trend where we're still seeing it?
That's a great question at 5:50. No, that's fantastic.
Can you just tell me your favorite color?
I'll start and then maybe something else that's like that. I mean, to me, I think that's where I think it's really important to work at all these different levels of policy, because where we see the SNAP conversation being really sort of stifled federally right now, you know, we might still be able to make some gains to get an incentive program funded in our city, right? And so, I mean, I think we really have to push where we can and get what we can where we can get it, and it can be really challenging sometimes given the political climate to get really what people deserve, frankly.
I would say also that what I think we're seeing is a need to get more innovative. So I'll give two specific examples. I mentioned that I was in Tucson earlier this fall. There was a food bank conference. So food banks have, you know, been in this category of emergency feeding for several decades now, with an eye towards ending hunger. What's happening is that there are food banks who are realizing we still have people who are hungry in this country. So let's look at that. Let's figure out if there's a new way to actually end hunger. So food banks are now starting farms. They're teaching people how to garden. We actually have a webinar next week happening to highlight three examples of this from around the country where food banks are buying product from farmers. For example, in New York, they're slicing apples and packaging them to go to schools. So I think that's one example of kind of what we're realizing needs to happen is, you know, with the Farm Bill, you have your commodity programs and then you've got your nutrition programs as kind of the two big chunks. That kind of relationship isn't necessarily working anymore. So then within the nutrition realm of things, the anti-hunger realm, trying to have to get creative and partner with the local food systems movement. And then another example I'll just quickly mention is looking now at nutrition incentives and farm to school programs specifically for military bases, because we know that a lot of military families are struggling and have to use SNAP or food stamps. So looking at how we can make sure that those families in service actually are able to feed themselves, buy products from the farmers in their community. So the, we're working right now with the Wholesome Wave Foundation, or with Wholesome Wave, to actually see if we can get funding to pilot that type of model at a military base in Virginia.
Do you have anything, Lisa?
I was going to say really quick, your question made me think about what Helen was saying before about the win-win-win. I think that the economy piece of that is something we really need to kind of get better at in public health. I didn't even, there are very few of any questions at the conference that I saw on like ROI. I think that whole concept of ROI, the concept of partnering.
Return on investment.
Thank you. Return on investment of all this stuff, with, you know, and also partner, you know, finding more folks who are in the business community, and you know, or looking at the economics of sustainable farming for school, and really promoting that angle is, I think, something that we ought to do more of, and that I think could help some backlighting where people are not necessarily responsive to the things that we need.
Yeah, and then related to that and the question about health professionals, another opportunity that we potentially have, assuming that the Affordable Care Act maintains itself and succeeds, is a lot of nonprofit hospitals have these community benefit dollars, and sometimes those go for like jump rope programs for kids at schools, which is great, it's physical activity, but those programs we could also start to use for food system change. And so doing a lot of education, this is taking a hugely massive federal program that could have really major impacts at a local level. And so to be building those relationships and partnerships between the hospitals, people already doing innovative food system work, and then educating those administrators on how their dollars could really impact their communities is something that we're looking at the Center for a Livable Future. Wholesome Wave is looking at it. I think the Union of Concerned Scientists, and it's, I think it's a huge opportunity, assuming this whole website glitch doesn't bomb the whole thing. So we have time for one or two more questions, and or if you are working on something that you want to share with this group of people who are being so wonderful and sticking around till 6 o'clock. So yeah. Great. And so tomorrow from 6:30 to 8 at Lucky's Lounge, which is a less than 20-minute walk, maybe even around 10 minutes from here, 355 Congress Street, 6:30 to 8, is the Food and Environment Working Group's networking reception. So there'll be some fantastic food hors d'oeuvre style available to you. There are a few mixed drinks that are going to be available made from local spirits until that runs out, and then you're buying your own. And I think also Yards Brewery, which is local, is going to come in and they'll be sampling some of their beers, and then those will also be available for purchase. So it'll be a really good time and a great time to continue this conversation. So spread the word and get there if you can. I think there's room for 120 to 150 people. So thank you very much. And thank you again to the panelists.